The conferences were pretty generally organized around the regular institute procedure, that is, with lectures, small discussion groups, all the conferees.
First off, I think what I'd like to know is a little bit about your background, your family background, and your early education. If you could start there.
Right. I was born in Kansas on my grandfather's homestead, the farm that he homesteaded. In fact, in a few days' time, I'm to receive the deed of that farm, and the deed will show that it was granted by Rutherford B. Hayes to my grandfather. My mother's had life ownership, life management of it, but the deed was never made out to her. And now, since she has died recently, the deed will be transferred to me, and so it's going to be a deed that has Rutherford B. Hayes to Nicholas Mark French to Martha Peterson. And he homesteaded that in the 1860s in Kansas, so that I was born on that homestead, lived there till I was about 12, went to a little country school, District 65, that no longer exists. My grandfather mostly taught me to read and write and do arithmetic, so I was a terrible pain in the neck to the people in that little District 65. I knew more than the teacher was ready to teach me at a given grade, but that was all right. Then we moved to town, and I went to the Jamestown Public Schools and through the 8th grade. Then my mother and father were divorced, and we moved to Salina. And part of the reason for choosing Salina was that my mother thought the schools there were very, very good. So I graduated from Salina High School, went directly to the University of Kansas, and majored in mathematics and German and Latin. Then taught for 5 years in small Kansas high schools, Ellenwood and Stockton, Stockton first and then Ellenwood. And came back to the university during the war years and taught Army, Navy, all that kind of people, and did my master's degree, and was through my coursework for my PhD in mathematics when Dean Mott, who was then chancellor at the university, persuaded me out to go into administration. After I'd been in administration a while, I thought I better know something about how people operate, so I finally did my PhD at Kansas with some supplementary work at Northwestern University in educational psychology and counseling.
Now, I want to back up a little bit to the point where you said you were majoring in math and Latin and German.
Mm-hmm.
Why these choices?
Oh, I'm not sure. I liked everything. And I went through a phase where I was going to be a social worker. That was my sophomore year. And then I tried sociology and found it a great waste of time. But in that period, I took Spanish. I'd taken German in high school. I'd taken 3 or 4 years of Latin in high school because of a very splendid teacher. Probably the best teacher I ever had was a high school Latin teacher. Mathematics I liked. It was just very easy for me to do, and I was excited about it. Came my junior year, and I had to declare a major in something, and I'd done all these things, and I knew by that time it wasn't going to be sociology or anything of that kind. So they said, what do you want to major in? And I said, mathematics and physics. And then I had the German background, the Latin background, but the head of the physics department, Mr. Stranathan, didn't think they needed a woman physics major. He said that he thought girls didn't do very well in physics. So I thought, okay, if they don't want me, I don't want them. And I love German, and German and mathematics would go together. So I just did the German mathematics major. And then I taught mathematics, and I taught Latin, and I taught German in high school, and I taught girls' physical education and a few dozen other things. But I just never thought of doing anything but mathematics.
Well, now the next question I have is, you said that you were sort of talked into the administrative role. Just what kind of talking was required?
Oh, well, let me recite. I was teaching, and that was the Army ASTP program, the Navy B-12 program, and even some Brooklyn boys who came out to learn to be bakers, and that was 8th grade arithmetic. And if you were in the math department at Kansas in those war years, sometimes I taught 7 and 8 classes a day. If they found more teachers, they only wanted you to do 3. But, you know, you were teaching, and it was for the war effort. And I had to go down to the other end of the administration building to teach some of my classes, and had to walk by the chancellor's office. And one day, just apropos of nothing, Dean Malott popped out and said, you know, I'd like to have you go into the Dean of Women's office one third time. And I said, I'm a mathematics teacher, and I don't believe I want to go into the Dean of Women's office one third time. Well, that happened for quite a few days. Every time I'd go or come from this particular class and went by his office, if he weren't busy, he'd be out there talking to me, stopping me and saying, have you thought about this? And finally he said, I want you to come in and talk to me seriously about it, because I think you should go into administration. So one day I went in and sat down, and one advantage of it, from my practical point of view, was the Army-Navy program was running out, and I could teach fall and winter semesters, nothing in the summer. And he said, you know, you can work at this in the summertime. And I said I didn't think I had any ability, but he thought I did, and particularly what he wanted me to handle was a sorority situation, the rushing, and that's a very, very competitive sort of thing. And this freshman women came in and went through rush week 10 days before the university started, and then when they didn't make the sorority they wanted, and only about a half could be pledged, they'd pick up and go home, and he thought it was a terrible situation and it was doing no good for the university. He thought I could handle that. And so we talked on rather seriously about it, but the big advantage was I could work in the summer. And what he thought was I could work full-time in the summer doing the assistant dean of women's bit. And then in the wintertime, I could teach and then just really a couple days a week work on this business in the wintertime. That was what his idea was.
Well, how did that work out?
Well, it worked out that I was working practically full-time at two jobs. That's how it worked out.
Yes, I would have thought the winter job would be more demanding than the summer.
Well, it worked out that way. But, he was very persuasive. And most people have persuaded me to try something else by saying, you know, this is an opportunity, and if you don't like it, you can always back off. And I thought I wouldn't be the kind of person that wasn't willing to dare. So I took it on, and then I became finally half-time assistant dean of women, and then dean of women at Kansas, and the mathematics just got less and less and less. I always tried to teach one class, but you know, that got to be kind of hard. And so when finally I was going seriously for my PhD in educational psychology and counseling, I stopped teaching altogether. That probably was 52 or 53.
Now, your choice of PhD subject was, I suspect, guided by this dean-type activity.
It was, and it was also the one area that I became convinced with what the people were doing at Kansas, that I could tie my mathematics in with it. And I had to go the statistics route, that I could use what I knew as a mathematics kind of discipline in the kind of thing I wanted to do, that at least there was a little bit of a tie between those two things. And a lot of other areas I might have been interested in, such as languages and history, it was going to be awfully hard to bring the mathematics in into any way. And so I was going to be a quantitative kind of psychologist, and counselor, and so on.
How did that work?
Well, I probably did the most uninteresting dissertation in the world.
What was the title?
The title of it was, I don't remember the title, Predictive Factors in Selecting Counselors. And I did a great statistical study, had people who were counselors in the dormitory, you know, resident counselors, undergraduates and graduate in the dormitory. They took all kinds of tests. They had to jump over all kinds of hurdles, have all kinds of interviews. Oh, they took the Minnesota Model Phasic Test and the Strong Vocational Interest Test and intelligence tests, and we had their grades and we had everything. And then I did a study to see which of these factors predicted the most success as dormitory counselor. And it turned out the factor that predicted their success most carefully most closely was whether or not they kept their appointments on time and got their work done on time. If we asked them to come on Tuesday at 10 and they got there, they were more likely to succeed than the one who didn't arrive until Friday at 2 o'clock. But there was a lot of statistics and analysis and all that sort of thing. And so, you know, in a way, but it's probably the dumbest dissertation anyone ever did.
It's been fun to check up years later and find out who did succeed.
Yeah. Well, anyhow, that's the way I put it together.
Well, then you came to the University of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Tell me about how that was arranged.
I was finishing my district, when I was taking my orals at Kansas. January, had taken the month of January off and was getting ready for my orals in February when Mr. Fred called me and said they were hunting for a dean. Did I know about that? And I said, no. And he said, well, former math major from Kansas is the dean here, Louise Fleming Troxell. She graduated mathematics from Kansas in 1919 or something. She's been a splendid dean of women, and your name's been suggested, and we thought there was sort of a parallel in the background. And I said, I couldn't do anything about it, which has been my reaction to almost anything anyone's asked me to do. I couldn't do anything about it because I was getting ready to take my orals. And typical E.B. Fred style, he said, well, now look, you've got to study, but there's a train out of Lawrence, Kansas that gets into, you can leave there at noon, you can get into to Chicago at night, you stay overnight in Chicago, you can study all the way in. Then there's a plane up to Madison very early on Friday morning, and you come up, and you'll have to be here all day Friday and Friday night and Saturday morning. But then you can go back to Chicago on Saturday afternoon, and there's a train back to Kansas on Saturday night. And so you'll lose out a couple of days, but you need a little break. So why don't you arrange to do this? And that seems so ultimately sensible that I said, fine, without thinking much about anything else. I really had not been out of Kansas, and I certainly had no intention of leaving Kansas. So I came up and was interviewed on Friday and Saturday. Splendid committee. Catherine Cleary was on that committee, and Ruth Wallerstein, Helen Laird, Carl Steiger, Julia, she taught home economics. Julia Dalrymple, Fred Haberman, well anyhow, I was, and Leroy Luberg was involved, and I met with the regents and all this sort of thing. Ira Baldwin and Edie Fred. It was a very pleasant experience. Then I went back to Kansas and went back to my studying and heard nothing about them at all for about 2 weeks, but I was so busy working that I didn't really much care. And I was going to take my orals on a Monday morning, start for 2 days. You had to write 2 days there on this thing. So I was to report at 8 o'clock on Monday morning and write all day Monday and all day Tuesday. And so my mother and I took Sunday off and drove down to Emporia and out in the country and came back in that evening, sort of relaxed, when Ira Baldwin called and said E.B. Fred had been quite ill in the hospital, and they hadn't been able to do anything, but they didn't want me to be dean. And would I be willing? They wanted to present my name to the regents, I guess, that Thursday or Friday or something. And would I be willing? And I said, oh dear, I've got to take my orals tomorrow, and I won't have any time to talk to Franklin Murphy, the chancellor. I won't have any time to do anything about it. And he said, well, do you think you'll take the job? And I said, I guess I will, but I just don't have any time to worry about it tonight or tomorrow. And he said, well, fine, we'll call you back on Wednesday, by Wednesday evening. And then if you'll do it, why, that'll be fine. And so I talked to Franklin Murphy, who thought I should do it. Everyone I talked to thought I should do it. And so I said, yes, I would. And that was the way that happened.
So that brought you to the university.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. I learned in the meantime, after I got up here, that E.B. Fred had talked to all kinds of people about me, even though he was in the hospital. One of the people was Dr. Bennett. She was his doctor. And he was in the hospital quite ill with pneumonia or something. And he came in one day and he said, you're from Nebraska. We're thinking of hiring this woman from Kansas. Will you look over her papers and see if she looks like someone you think you'd like to have around? And so she stood by his bed and went over all my papers. And person after person has told me that along the course of the way, he'd approach him, and the comment he made to Louise Troxell, Louise and Emily Turbinick and Helen Kaiser, apparently, after they interviewed me, said that they thought I'd be fine. But one of the comments to Louise after he checked on what she had to say was, she didn't seem the least bit spavined to me. Which spavined is a good agricultural term for a horse that's kind of broken down. So he apparently was very busy, and all kinds of people told me all kinds of tales about it. I must say on my end, I didn't do much checking. I'd reached a point I could leave Kansas, and this seemed like an opportunity, and I suppose I'm a fairly ambitious person, even though I haven't ever charted my course, that when opportunities come along, I'm willing to be.
Well, I suppose you knew enough about the University of Wisconsin as an institution.
And I had a great time here that day, and the people I met, many of them turned out to be just that committee, my closest friends in my years at the university. So
the people on the committee?
Yes, we did.
How nice.
It's still, Catherine Cleary still comes up to visit me. Mel Lair got acquainted with me through his mother. He's a good friend nowadays.
Well, I guess now specifically I'd like to talk about what you found when you arrived here as Dean of Women, what the situation was like.
That's a hard one. After I'd accepted the job, and I guess before I accepted it, I'd had only one concern about Wisconsin, and that was the fact that Senator McCarthy was a senator.
Oh, yes.
And while I wasn't a raving liberal politically, I wasn't a raving liberal at all. In fact, I probably was more a Republican coming from Kansas than a Democrat. You almost had to be a Republican in Kansas, so my political affiliation wasn't well identified. But I certainly had some concerns about black folks. We had taken black women into the dormitory at Kansas during the time that I was dean, and they had before been required to live outside, and quite a lot of things of that kind that I had stood up for. We had made some changes in the sorority system, and there were a good many people thought I was out to kind of a socialist in my attitude, and while I knew that I wasn't this flaming liberal, I knew that there were people who thought I was sort of way far out.
What kind of changes are you thinking of?
Well, at Kansas, where they'd had sorority rushing in August before the students ever came on campus, and there was all this very unusual kind of activity. During the years that I was there, we delayed pledging till the sophomore year, so the women came on and lived in the dormitory 1 year without being members of sororities, and national leaders in sororities thought that was a sure demise of the sorority system. They were sure anyone who did that or approved of that was trying to break up the sorority system altogether. And so it was that, you know, and then, well, putting black girls into the dormitory. It was a big shock to Kansas, the Regents passed a regulation that all women had to live in the dormitories their first year at Kansas. That was one of the things that came along with the sorority thing. And so my colleague and I in the dean's office decided that meant all women. And so we didn't go back and say, did you mean black women who had been excluded? We simply began assigning them and did it very quietly. We had only one reaction, and that was a reaction from a mother who said, which bathroom will they use? Those girls that are living down the hall from my daughter, and the counselor happened to be well-trained, and we worked on this enough to say, well, I'm not sure. There's a bathroom here, and there's a bathroom there. It's probably the one they want to go to, and as far as I know, that was. But that doesn't mean there wasn't a lot of underground seething that we had taken black women. Well, that sort of thing we had done at Kansas. And I was sure there were people who could make statements. And so I raised the question about Senator McCarthy and was told that to not to worry about it, that the people at the university, that he didn't pick fights with them, and they didn't think that he'd pick
fights. That's true. He left the University of Wisconsin alone.
And that they didn't think he'd pick a fight over me. And when I told them all these bad deeds that I had done, they said they didn't think that would get me into any trouble in Wisconsin at all. So I did raise that question. That was the only question I had. But I came in, by the time I came, with tremendous respect for the academic freedom, for the staff at the University of Wisconsin, what it represented academically, and so on. And its excellence, and really was prepared to be very much at home with the kind of ideas I had about what people did who were scholars and how you treated students who were learners. And I was pretty astounded at the rigidity of the regulations governing students and the attitudes and discipline toward students. Kansas was much freer, much more liberal in terms of counting students in as a part of student government and in the number of regulations. And yet Kansas was supposed to be, you know, a conservative state that didn't see ahead. And that was a great shock for me.
It surprises me.
Yeah, it's it seemed to me a very rigid, authoritarian kind of way of running things in the dormitories and in discipline, and students were involved, but it struck me as a, well, I had a hard time understanding what it was, because I believed that you could sit down with students and say, here are, they didn't decide things, but here are the limits within which we'll work. Now let's see what we can do. Or if you had to say, here's something that can't go on, you said, here's something that can't go on, now how do we handle it? That was my way of working. And I found that it was much, much more rigid. I came to understand why better, why later on, more than I did in those first years. So yeah, I was young then. Gee, and idealistic, and had finished a PhD in counseling guidance, and I suppose that the people at Wisconsin felt some of these things weren't important enough to worry about. You know, just make a rule and handle that. Don't go through all this soul searching about whether closing hours will be 10:30 or 11. It's easier to handle. So, and I think in some ways I was fairly naive. But I think in other ways that Wisconsin was pretty authoritarian for all their academic freedom. In certain areas, I think they were pretty authoritarian, and that was a big shock for me.
Do you have any way of accounting for this attitude?
Yes. I think in some ways it was an easy way of handling things in a larger institution that had been challenged an awful lot by all kinds of people. This was an easy way of handling it. It didn't get the minutiae in the way of doing the major thing that the university stood for, which was a great deal of freedom, teaching and learning and that sort of thing. And why let the peripheral things, take major importance? It was more important that they think clearly and be challenged, sift and winnow, for instance, in the classroom, than it was to worry about what time you eat meals or that sort of thing. And so I think I think it was just a matter of accommodation. And then I think there is in Wisconsin a curious kind of authoritarianism, both in their politics and everything else. You know, that it's great freedom, but there's also a great deal of, even throughout the state. And so it fitted with the old German kind of approach to raising a family. It fitted very well with it. But it was a surprise to me. Such a surprise that I think, I'm not sure whether it was the end of the second or the third year, that I went to see Ira Baldwin and said, you know, I don't think the way I operate fits quite with the university. I think I'm another kind of person, and I think you've pretty well established what you want to do here. Your regulations of dormitories and fraternities, and the way you handle discipline, and how you do things, I think you're pretty well set. And I think I'm only going to upset the apple cart if I stay around or be unhappy myself. And Wisconsin was here long before I came, and I've been here a couple of years, and I just think maybe be smart. I'm sort of a thorn in a good many people's sides. Maybe it'd be smart if I moved out quietly in a year or so. And his response was, we knew what we were getting when we got you, and we want you. And it won't be easy on you always to fight these battles, but we think it'll be good for the university to have a person of your kind balancing some of the other forces. But I was ready at the end of a couple of years just to say this, and there's no reason to change Wisconsin if they believe in it and it's working. There's no reason to change them, but maybe I'm not the person for the job. But he convinced me I should stay.
Well, what were some of these battles that seemed inevitable?
Oh, I suppose in the dormitories, just sort of hard and fast rules, and what you did when people broke the rules. And Newell Smith and I had many a battle, and by the time I left Wisconsin, Neil Smith and I were just the best of friends, but we had many a battle, and I got the kind of feeling that Newell conveyed to me was that you give on this line and you listen to this person, or in this situation you do what's best for the learning of the student. And he would admit this, you know, maybe it's better the student will learn more if you do this, but you do that, then you'll have 40 others that you have to deal with, and we got all these dormitories and we got to run them. When we chose counselors, I forget what they call it, but they live in each of the dormitories. We had a long interview, and I was always looking for the person that I thought would be more of a counselor than a disciplinarian. And we had head-on battles about that. And I was constantly pushing for the individual and the rights and freedom of the individual, as opposed to make Elizabeth Waters run, this is what we got to do. I would get difficulties over, such things, you know, the closing hours then, and what they did with students who violated the closing hours, didn't come in, and particularly if they got caught, and I always had this argument, it was better for them to understand it than to close your eyes when you knew the rule was being broken. Either understand it and change the rule than to just close your eyes. Well, we battled over numerous things of that kind, and I kept nudging, but usually lost. And they kept on running the dormitories the way they were running them. I had some problems over, I suppose, things like fraternities and sororities, closing your eyes because they were fraternities and sororities to some of the drinking problems and some of the other problems that they had. And mine, I don't think, was a Puritan attitude, but I just thought you recognized them. If you're trying to teach people, then you did something with them. And, Ted Silliman, I did battle over any number of things that in cases where students have been caught violating regulations that came before the disciplinary committee, you just about count on it. Ted Zillman and I were voting on the opposite side of what we should do, whether we should drop them or, you know, that sort of thing. It just came up all the way along the line. It was a difference in approach. And as I say, I think I was fairly naive, but I think Wisconsin was awfully rigid from an authoritarian.
Well, Ted Selman was Dean of Men at this time, wasn't he? Mm-hmm. I was going to ask, because I'm aware that lots of disciplinary problems certainly concerned men and women simultaneously, and I'm wondering how you worked out this arrangement.
Personally, it was a good relationship. You know, on the social level or on the level where we didn't come into areas of overlap. You could just almost count on it that when it came into an area of discipline or making a decision, Ted and I would probably be on the opposite side. It sort of came to accept that, but apparently it had been that way with Louise Troxell and Ted, and everyone around the university kind of expected that. And I think someone attributed it to, you know, the soft-headed Dean of Women's Office and the really strong Dean of Men's Office that kept the university together.
Do you have any overall opinion as to how these came out, these disagreements, in terms of the what was done for the students?
Yes. On the whole, I think we resolved our disagreements rather well, and we did it because there were faculty members on the committee, all the committees, disciplinary committees, housing committees, union committees. Porter Butts and I didn't see eye to eye on how you managed things. We were often in arguments about what you were doing. But there were always faculty members on the committees, or there were always staff members. And when things got pretty head on, where it looked like a crisis, you could usually count on someone to come in and kind of soften it and get it so you both could live with it. I think of phone calls that I got from people, well, name some names. Willard Hurst, I suspect, did Hartshorn from time to time. Leroy Luberg, other people who come in and say, look, sometimes they say, we think you're right on this, and we're going to see what we can do. Chan Young was another. We're going to see what we can do to get Ted Zillman to change his opinion. So we think you're dead right on this. Other times they'd say, you're going to have to give a little. But I think we managed most of the way, and not because we could. We're going to see what we can do to get Ted Zillman to change his opinion. So we think you're dead right on this. Other times they'd say, you're going to have to give a little. But I think we managed most of the way, and not because we could do it face to face, but because there were a lot of people in the university who understood issues more than just the personal part of it, and cared enough about the university and the students, and it mostly, I think, came out very well for the students. I don't think they were mistreated in any way whatsoever. I think they got a very fair shake.
Credits that a student had to carry. This was also changed at the same time and on the same vote. And I objected to that because I thought that all students should be carrying 12 credits rather than any number of credits, because some students could get higher grade point averages by carrying fewer credits, and they enhance their grade point.
Now, I'm assuming that you were on all these committees you were just referring to.
Most of them.
Discipline.
You were automatically as dean. The ones where you came into any kinds of conflicts you were on. Uh-huh. Sure.
Well, you mentioned Porter Butts and the union. What was your role in the union?
I'm not sure. Porter Butts ran his own show, but he certainly served on lots of the committees, like the Student Life and Interest Committee. And this is where he would go for his approval, and that's usually where there, you know, you made your compromises and argued about it. But Porter was in charge of the union, and he ran a good union, too.
Well, he had very firm notions, I learned, about the use of students' so-called leisure, or at least mm-hmm. out-of-class time, mm-hmm. as being opportunities for education mm-hmm. and other areas.
He was a leader in that field, in developing it. Mm-hmm.
And did you agree with him on this?
I certainly agreed with him on what he was trying to do. Again, I guess I felt he was a little too autocratic in his decisions of politics, of what was good and what wasn't good. But he ran a good show, and the students who were over there, the leaders, learned a great deal about leadership and carrying responsibility.
Yeah, which was, understand, a primary objective of his.
They were an elite group, and I suppose that offended me a little bit. I didn't think they ought to be quite that elite, that all sorts of people ought to be able to participate, but I guess when you're responsible for the amount of money and the building and the program he's responsible for, you have to have people working with you that you can count on.
Yes, I'm sure that's true. He didn't seem himself, when I discussed this with him, to consider it an elite group. He liked the notion that it was for everybody, but I suppose it may not have worked that way. Well, you were talking about sororities and fraternities, or sororities principally. How did they fit in with the dormitory regulations and things of that nature?
There, Helen Kaiser in the Dean of Women's Office was responsible for sororities, and she had a long tradition of working with them. And then when she retired, Ann Rogers came in, and Ann came from the South and was not as schooled in the background of sororities as Helen was, particularly at Wisconsin. But it was less of a problem at Wisconsin, the working relationship between sororities and the dormitories. Much less of a problem was, say, at Kansas. At Kansas, there were people who felt that they just were not socially acceptable unless they were in a sorority. Your whole life was ruined. You weren't going to marry the right man, and all of this. Wisconsin was much more flexible about it. So the relationships, as a result, were not so tense. Sororities sort of ran their own show down in Langdon, and there was some conflict between the sororities and the dormitories, but the dormitories also had so many good things going for them that they didn't worry too much about the sororities and fraternities, or so it seemed to me. So I did not sense in that area too much conflict.
That worked out fairly well.
Yeah, that worked out fairly well. It was a different world, Langdon Street. And dormitories. Well, the union was a different, people who worked in the union, that was a different world, but Wisconsin was big enough to have all these worlds without fighting and having the stamp put on that you were a nobody if you weren't part of one or the other. That didn't happen too much, I think, in Wisconsin.
You also had responsibility for, I assume, for students' personal problems. Did you have a lot of personal problems? I mean, a lot of different kinds?
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. They were regularly referred to us, and this would be another area of conflict. Some of the head residents, some of the people would refer them, some of the house mothers and sororities and fraternities would refer them. Some of them would prefer not to wash their dirty linen in public for fear, reporting that such and such had happened in their housing unit. Well, and then there were all the privately owned dormitories and houses too, and sometimes they didn't want to report them for fear this would be a black mark against them. They ought to run their own show and not do their dirty linen in public. But I don't think, when push got to shove, or some student was really having a tough time, we regularly got it. And we were the persons they called, someone in the office, and we worked with the house mothers and the counselors and the head residents and the owners of the dormitories and faculty members and the academic dean's office and so on in trying to work out these personal problems. We had a very good working relationship with the student health. They were very good and very helpful. And with the Division of Student Psychiatry. Trying to think now the name of the man who was there for so many years and went from there to Duke. who was really very good. We had a good working relationship. And then the counseling bureau was very good for different kinds of problems, so we had lots of backup support. But we had a great many of them. In fact, I think the office may have done more of that than is traditional in this kind of a university. I think we had lots of people with good problems to us.
You think you had more of this than, say, your predecessor, Louise Troxell?
No, I think Louise had built this tradition. I think probably, though, that we had more of it here at Wisconsin, more referral, than you would at a Minnesota or a Michigan or some of the other places. I think that this, we were the office that did that kind of thing. And people rather trusted us, as students and faculty alike, and they got to trust us, knew we could be trusted, and maybe we could even be helpful sometimes. So parents, we were sort of the spot where they came.
Did you do a fair amount of work with parents?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And here again was a point where there were some differences of opinion in the university. Some people felt parents, when they sent their sons or daughters to the university, that was that. They were grown up, and that was that. There were others felt that any problem involved a son or daughter should be reported to the parents by the university. I sort of occupied a middle ground and I think my standard statement to students as I was dealing with them was one of, now are you going to tell you, when I thought it was something that parents had to know, that this was going to interfere with the career of the student, are you going to tell your father or mother or am I? And sometimes they'd say, I'd like to go away and think about that a half day, which one of us is going to do it? But my approach was sort of in that. I didn't very often call parents unless requested to do so by the student, but I did use this other whip of either you are or I am.
Probably on something they'd rather their parents weren't told about.
I also encouraged Dr. Flynn Ressler. And Dr. Ressler and Cy, some of their other in the psychiatry department, would encourage them, if possible, the parents to call them, because I thought if it was that kind of a matter, or a counselor in the counseling bureau, rather than having an administrator, I could outline the problem to the parent, but I thought they ought to get in touch with the person who knew the most about it. And as we developed a reputation for that, we found parents calling us at times and trusting us and asking us to look when they knew that. I don't think parents want the didn't think parents wanted the university to come between them and their son or daughter. And if you tried to maintain that so that the communication stayed open there as much as you could, you found students and you found parents trusting you. So that seemed to me to increase in the years that I was there. Parents, well, maybe parents were more troubled.
Well, who knows, but it does sound like a good development to me.
Well, I that was one area where I thought we developed some good working relationships, but it was always on the basis of, we're not going to tell them unless, you know, if you can do it, we'd rather have you do it. And most of us that worked in the office had that philosophy.
What parts of your job did you find the most difficult?
In the long run, and the reason I decided to leave the Dean of Women's office, in the long run, it was doing the same thing year after year. Having to get excited about orientation week, having to get excited about actually doing a sort of routine regulation sort of thing. It didn't bother me to have to deal with a new problem that might come to my attention because someone was violating closing hours, but just having to deal with the routine, they were 20 minutes late, therefore they got so many late notices, and then they had to be campused, and all of that kind of, sort of, I couldn't work up my enthusiasm for it, and I found myself going to mortarboard elections, for instance, and thinking, we can take care of this in one evening if they just get busy. and vote on it, but they would take 17 meetings, and I knew it wasn't fair to the student. I had no enthusiasm. I'd been through it so often that I knew I wasn't bringing the enthusiasm, and yet this was the first time for them. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like the classroom, although I suppose I stopped teaching calculus because I thought, I don't know what's going to happen to calculus if I have to teach it 50 times over, because it's sort of limited in what you do, and the change factor is the student. But still, calculus, and I had some of the same feeling in the dean's office, that I wasn't bringing the enthusiasm to that routine kind of thing. And so when I went to Fred Harrington and said, look, I think maybe, I guess I went to Mark England, I wanted to go back and teach mathematics, and I said, I think I can manage the administrative side, but some of these things that the dean does, I've lost enthusiasm for, and I can hire people who can do it, and who will be just so excited about them, but I can't get excited every time over, so that's the reason for that. And so that was a part of it. Not the dealing with the individuals, but that part of it. Perhaps.
You want me to ask?
Yes, would you ask this question you suggested a few minutes ago about
Before he goes for a walk, that's
right. Yeah. I overheard you about the saying that the union, Fort Butts had an elite group of students grading in the union, and it did a very good job, which I had observed, but I wondered how he got an elite group. In a similar question, I found that women students were objecting to the rules for the hours rules. Coming back to dormitories, particularly because it was just after the war and there were a number of older women students who had been out working and now being treated as adolescents rather than bachelors. They wanted me as a faculty member to get these rules changed. The faculty, I said, well, look, who made these rules? The Women's Self-Government Association. Yes, but the officers elected for that weren't the right people. You're doing it. I said, who elected them? Well, we did, but we weren't effectively organized. I had a feeling that a good many of them were students who were attracted, as one well would be, by Louise Troxell's dean personality, and admired her greatly, so that maybe they simply went along with her ideas, but I didn't know. How did that operate?
Well, I think this elitism, and it occurred in almost all the governing associations. I think even the WSA, Wisconsin Student Association, wasn't quite as rigid as AWS, the Associated Women Students, that made the rules for women. But in the union, it was all kind of organized in an authoritarian kind of way, sort of like the army. You know, you win your brownie points, you do your work at a certain level, and then you move up and apply for the next level, and the people who make the choices are the ones who have been observing this. In the union, Porter Butts and his group, although the students worked in the selection, he was right there. So you'd served your apprenticeship, your freshman year, your sophomore year, and you were winnowed out, and you had your brownie points, and the ones that eventually went into the presidency of the union was one who had fit that very clear pattern that I would say was more allied to promotion in the army than election in a democratic procedure. And I think the same thing happened in Associated Women Students. They worked up in the same kind of way. And I've not ever thought of it till you asked this question. When you were saying, when I was trying to describe what shocked me at Wisconsin, I guess this was one of the things, that kind of a rigid sorting out the elite who took the responsibility. That I guess would be what I saw. And to me, it ought to be all of them, and I had to deal with this students all the time who would come in and say, this is just crazy, and I'd agree with them, just crazy what we're doing, it's just crazy. Well, then why don't you get your dormitory officers to do differently? You elected them. Well, but we didn't really elect them. We sort of had two choices, and these choices were approved by the organization that really was in charge. It was a very comfortable way of doing business. You got superb people in some of those jobs who turned out unusually well.
Control of the nominations.
Yeah, it was really control of the nominations.
Well, under these conditions, if you wanted to change some of these regulations, how did one look at it?
Oh, I don't know. You sent signals of by not always fitting in with what our students are pretty canny. They know the rules, and they didn't have time to spend all their hours, and they knew, and if the rule was just totally absurd, then you found ways of getting around it that didn't get you into trouble. And I guess when they saw people, and they saw not just the Dean of Women, I don't want, you know, I wasn't Don Quixote riding in. There were a lot of faculty members. There were the Ira Baldwins, a lot of others that thought we ought to loosen this up a little bit and get more general participation. When they saw this come, that there were people that would support them, they began to ask more questions, to raise more questions, and I think to be freer. We were beginning in the early 60s to get to more sense of responsibility on the part of the officers, that they represented the students as a whole, and that they should be thinking about students as a whole, not what we wanted in order to make the university run smoothly. Then, of course, then you have to wonder, is that the reason the whole thing blew up? And it isn't, because it blew up all over the country. But I'm sure there are people who worked in the old system who think that Wisconsin would have been highly in control if we hadn't been relaxing things like closing our rules, and if we hadn't been putting so much responsibility on students, that if we had the old discipline, that we might not have fallen apart as much as we did. I don't think so.
You're now talking about the protest times.
Yeah, the protest in the late 60s. I think that was a product of something quite different, but I think we were beginning to put more responsibility on students and have wider participation.
Getting away from this old idea of parentis and locus, mm-hmm. kind of thing. That, mm-hmm. Of course, that was true of many institutions earlier.
They were all
earlier
in
on.
The way.
Certainly, my college had these kind of regulations.
My hunch is that we lost being in loco parentis. It took 20 years for it to take over, but we lost it, and Mr. Hartshorn was mentioning in Midgar, we lost it. The concept of ever being in loco parentis right after the war, World War II. We had all the students back on campus, older men who'd been in the army. We just sort of said, this is an aberration. But then came 1950 and 52, they left, and we went right back. And the way we managed it, the war years, I think in most places, was not to change the rules that much, but to make exception for these older guys and gals and sort of shut our eyes. And then when it went back to being a younger campus again, we put all the same old rules, same old things back in force. And we held for a while. That was a kind of a quiet generation. We held for a while. But we'd had a whole crew on the campus who'd lived differently and who'd talked about it. And when they came back to the fraternities, or when they'd talk about how they, and when their sons and daughters arrived, their concept, the myths about a college campus, were the myths of the 40s, the tales that their dads and mother had told. And they just weren't about to accept. And they had been brought up differently in their own homes, but they weren't about to accept. And so the colleges had gone one way, back into the old in loco parentis. Parents had gone another, and about in the 60s, early 60s, it just got so far apart. And the one that had to give was the college campus, and had to say, you know, you're pretty grown up when you come to college.
Which was a new view at that time, I guess.
Quite a new view. My heavens. It was hard to have anyone do anything because you said so. that didn't happen. They did it, they questioned, and that was good. But my hunch is that that all started to fall away with World War II, that we on the college campus didn't recognize this thing as we should.
It seemed to, a lot of this came up, as I seem to recall, in the 60s with the notion of education is how relevant is what I'm studying. And this came up, the stress on it seemed to me to start then.
Yes, it did.
And has gone on, maybe not so.
Maybe turning back a little bit now, I don't know.
Yes, I don't think people are as noisy about it as they once were.
A little bit more willing now to say that it's, you know, you may learn something you can't use tomorrow, but it's still worth learning.
Now, I'd like to know something about the mechanics of all of this. You're talking about house mothers. I mean, obviously these dormitories had to have somebody on the site.
Dormitories and sororities and fraternities, some of them. Mm-hmm.
How were they selected?
Well, in the dormitories, there was, they were hired, of course, by the director of dormitories. And that was a whole hierarchy. Director of housing was Newell Smith, and then there were people in charge of different units of it. But the Dean of Women's Office always participated in the interviews, and either the dean or an associate dean would serve on the committees doing the interviews and bringing them in. And while the director of housing made the final, did the hiring, it was always with the approval of the Dean of Women. In the sororities, almost the same system. In the last years, there were so few people available that the Dean of Women's Office served a major function in identifying candidates, so that before they even got started, they'd come in and say, do you have any applicants? Because we don't know anyone. For a long time, it was a job that there were plenty of people to fill. Then there weren't. And so we often were the ones that supplied all the names that they went out and interviewed, and then it was sort of a cooperative.
Why was this change, this shift from lots of possible people to...
Oh, well, house mothers, how long have they had them? I don't know. But certainly in the 1930s, Depression years, this was a marvelous job. And it was through the 40s, marvelous job for a person who'd managed a home. Then as the dormitories got bigger, as they wanted counselors, as you had to do more business management, those dormitories, those jobs became positions that, well, now Wisconsin used a lot of school teachers, people who had taught school. You needed more training and skill than you got in just running a home and raising two sons and daughters. But so the qualifications, the demands went up, and then also there were more jobs. And being a house mother, while it might appeal to you if all you'd done all your life was be in a home, this was sort of an extension of the home on a professional kind of way, it might appeal to you. A lot of women found it just terrible. For 24-hour-a-day job, they had to order, they had to plan, they had to teach manners, they had to handle all these wild young ones, they had, you know, and they could get a job someplace else. And so there were more jobs, and there were more demands, and it just sort of dried up.
Yeah, I can see that. I did note that at some point they had workshops for house mothers. Did you participate in any of these?
Yes, in fact, many of them I organized, and it came apparent that people needed to know more than they knew, that they wanted to know more than they knew, and there were some pretty good people around the country who could come in. And so we had Ruth McCarn, who'd been Dean of Women at Northwestern, who was very able, come in. Remember, we had a Lutheran minister, and that was really a traumatic one, who was leading in the field of how to deal with death and sorrow and letting go. And Ruth McCarn had suggested him that he was very good, that he would be very useful with the house mothers on two scale points, that most of them had to give up something in coming into the house mother position. Many of them came in out of some trauma, and it would be useful to them personally, but also that they were dealing with students who were increasingly having divorces in their family, or tragedies, or something of that kind.
Sometimes college students lose a parent.
And that there were all kinds of things happening to them. And I remember that workshop very well. We had Doris Seward, who ran a house mother for years. Doris Seward had run a house mother training institute. We had a number of people across the country who were skilled in the area of working with people who weren't exactly, who started different professional levels, who weren't really professionally trained, but who were longing, needing more help. And so we did those, yes. They worked out pretty well. Morale, learning, and everything else.
Well,
Wisconsin was great on workshops, too. I think some of it was they were being treated as other people were being treated at the university. They were getting the same kind of opportunity that historians have who go off to learn how to do their business. They were being recognized professionally.
Which was nice.
Yeah, it was nice. And those were happy occasions.
Now, I guess there's one issue particularly that I wanted to ask you about. You mentioned having sort of integrated dormitories at Kansas,
mm-hmm.
and there was a situation here, and in particular the one that I've noted is the one about a girl, I think from Beloit actually, the Delta Gamma girl situation,
she was a Madison
about getting
girl.
Into a sorority,
mm-hmm.
and I heard something about this. I'd like you to give me any details you recall about this situation, because it created quite a furor.
Yes. Patty Hamilton grew up in Madison. Her family had always lived there, certainly well respected. Her older brother had gone to Beloit and was a member of a fraternity down there, Teak, I think. Patty went to Beloit and was pledged by the Delta Gamma chapter there. Now I'll be speaking both of Beloit information and University of Wisconsin
That's
information.
Fine.
Because a lot of this, after I was president of Beloit, I heard even more about it. Patty was pledged. Then sometime after, and I don't know how much dealings went on here, but sometime thereafter, the National Delta Gamma withdrew the charter for the Delta Gamma chapter at Beloit. They did it on the basis, the statements on the basis of their failure, the Delta Gamma chapter of Beloit, their failure to supply records and to conform with many of the requirements of the national organization for their local chapters. And I had the slightest doubt after being on the Beloit campus that this was probably true. Beloit is a very small college. The fraternities and sororities, loosely organized. And I suppose they saw no great deal in having to send in the names of the people they were pledging the night they pledged them. I don't think they probably got around to paying their dues until they got around to paying their dues. They were small, it was a very informal kind of organization, and I would guess that National Delta Gamma could go down their records and cite case after case of this report was due November 10th, it came in January 13th, this money was due this date, it came in that date, this list of officers was due at this time, and we didn't get them till a year later, and then we came out to visit, and everyone had gone home for interterm, and they hadn't told us. I would assume